and welcome to the 12th episode of Season 8 of The Dark Money Files, in which we shine a light into a murky world. I am Ray Blake, and with me is my co-host, friend, and business partner, Graham Barrow. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Ray.
Now, judging from the listener stats, people enjoyed our first visit to the dark side, didn't they, Graham?
Yeah, well, Ray, bad is always popular. Mm. And I've got to say, you know, listening back to that last episode, and I don't always, it's pretty clear to me we were enjoying ourselves as much as we have on, well, any episode we've done previously.
Well, there was a certain amount of chuckling going on, I'd have to agree. And today we're going global, aren't we?
Well, yes. Having covered the more traditional forms of cash money laundering, we're going to look at laundromats.
And not the places down your local high street, if such a thing still exists where you are, where you take your washing.
Well, I think they do, but it's been a few years since I've done that, right? Mm. But no, not one of those.
We are instead talking about the global networks of companies and bank accounts through which billions of pounds, dollars and euros have been laundered over the last couple of decades. What we sometimes refer to as trade-based money laundering.
Yeah, and I think it's probably hundreds of billions, right? Mm. But, I mean, there's a point where the figures themselves become almost meaningless.
Well, not to the people deprived of them, Graham.
No, and that's a really good point, Ray, and one we should never forget. Every penny or cent laundered must, by the very fact it's being laundered, have once belonged to someone else. Now, whether that was through paying tax or buying goods or whatever, you can't launder legitimate funds.
Mm. Nevertheless, today, at least in our imaginations, and only in our imaginations, I can't stress that too much, we are going to become high-end global money launderers. How exciting. And where do we start?
Well, I think we need a clearly thought-through strategy to begin with.
Well, I've often said as much, Graham. I agree in this case. As we've mentioned before, high-end money laundering is performed as a service to criminal gangs and corrupt politicians, public servants and the like. So our first strategy should be to make sure we don't lose any of it.
It would be a deadly error. In the absolute strict meaning of that word.
Yeah, yeah. So what's our starting point, given this?
Well, right, I'd say we need to build this network on two pillars. Pillar one, geographic spread. Pillar two, complexity.
Yeah, now I think we should break each of those pillars down into simpler parts, shouldn't we?
We should. Do you want to start with the geographic spread pillar?
Well, I'd love to. Now, look, the last thing we need is for one specific law enforcement agency to have control of any investigation. To avoid that, we need to make sure our network touches as many different countries as possible, preferably including many that are not traditionally cooperative, so that it's not possible for any one agency or jurisdiction to have oversight or build a coalition behind the entire operation.
Exactly. Our second pillar, complexity, is designed to circumvent any country which has legislation designed to get round geographical spread by simply focusing on the funds arriving in their country rather than those countries it travels through on the way there.
Oh, yeah. Now, we achieve that complexity in several ways, don't we?
We do. We're going to create a huge range of corporate entities which will take on a variety of roles and will be, to some degree, location dependent.
And alongside that, we'll constantly break down large amounts into smaller amounts, move them through the system, sometimes bringing them back together or mixing them up even more, until it's impossible to tell what belonged to who and when.
If we're going to do this, Ray, we're going to need a pretty substantial number of operatives to track all this cash and make all these transactions, not to mention the paperwork we're going to have to fabricate to support all these money movements.
Well, you're right, Graham, but if we're going to be laundering hundreds of billions of dollars or whatever for people who have neither the time nor the expertise to do it themselves, they won't mind paying a decent percentage to get it done, if it then means that they can enjoy the fruits of their crimes in reasonable safety from prosecution.
Right. Well, let's start setting up some companies. Where do we start then, Ray?
Oh, your favourite place, Graham. Companies House. It's cheap, quick and easy. UK companies are regarded as low risk all over the world. They provide an excellent starting point.
But we also have a completely transparent register, Ray. How are we going to get round that?
Well, it may be transparent, Graham, but it's not verified. We're going to create our companies using a combination of legal entities in places like the Marshall Islands, Nevis, the Seychelles and Dominica, which don't provide any details to the general public.
Yeah, and there are other locations which sit somewhere in between, places like Cyprus and Panama, which do publish director details, but little else.
Mm.
How many are we going to need, Ray?
Well, in terms of the offshore companies, just a couple, probably. But in terms of the UK entities, several thousand.
Which may come as something of a surprise to some of our listeners, but it's true. We've analysed just one part of one network and discovered 2,500 linked limited liability partnerships.
And as you say, this is just a small part of a bigger network.
Yeah, all of which will have bank accounts across a large number of banks in a large number of different countries.
It's a heck of an administrative task running one of these laundromats, isn't it? Now, we should talk about these banks and their locations next.
Yeah, now, if you analyse the banks involved in past laundromats, most of them are small local banks in new or emerging economies, often on the fringes of the European Union.
Like some of the banks which were named at the time in Latvia, Lithuania and Estonia.
Yes, other banks in other countries are also involved. But for the reported laundromats over the last few years, these have been the centre of attention.
Doesn't mean they're the only ones, just the only ones that we've really found so far.
Yeah,
and Danske Bank, possibly the best known case, is a bit of an outlier here, isn't it?
Yeah, because it was part of a major banking group, although, as it turns out, for reasons that we have discussed before at some length, it was operating more like a local satellite branch or franchise, as it wasn't properly connected to the group systems and controls.
Right. So we've incorporated thousands of companies in myriad countries, opened bank accounts in mainly small, accommodating banks. What do we need to do now?
We need to start fabricating a whole heap of contracts, Ray.
Why is that?
Well, if we're going to be moving massive sums of money through the world's banking system, we'll need some supporting evidence. So we're going to be producing contracts for building materials, technology, textiles, manufacturing, and anything else that looks vaguely legitimate.
I remember last week when we spoke about taxis and training services and catering and all of those things. We're just talking about the same thing, but on a global scale, aren't we, really?
We absolutely are.
So I guess once it's in the system, it's not quite so important, but it's the point of arrival into the EU that matters. It's what appears on the wire transfers, which is the first hurdle to overcome.
Exactly. And now we've got all that done, we should set the scene.
Let's. Now, we've got operatives in a variety of countries where the ruling elite, and we're not going to name names, have need of our services. The good thing is that in their country, they have reasonable autonomy over local banking. So money can be moved out through a variety of local enterprises, in quotes, with accompanying paperwork.
Yes, but of course less control over the arrival point, which is why it pays to have friendly faces at the receiving end.
Or, to put it another way, it's why we pay to have friendly faces at the receiving end.
Very good, yeah. Indeed. And they will do a number of things for us. They will advise us of local limits which trigger transaction alerts. They will let us know any specific due diligence requirements. They help us to understand how best to structure our transactional activity to avoid setting off any alarms.
Like telling us that inbound payments from other jurisdictions trigger a specific alert at, say, €1 million for corporate transactions.
Yeah, so we will structure our payments just under that level.
Mm. And there's no alert system for transfers within the branch, say.
So we will open lots of accounts in the name of different companies at the same branch, and we'll move money between those companies with extreme frequency.
A little bit like, do you remember all those Western shows when we were young, and the fleeing fugitive would run through a river, which would put the dogs off the scent? yeah. It's a little bit like that, isn't it, Graham?
Yeah.
So, and I mean, another useful thing to know might be that the alert system only runs overnight, so that any payments that are triggered only get frozen then.
Well, yes, and we will then ensure wherever possible the money comes in, goes out again on the same day.
Mm. And maybe there's an alert for unusually high overnight balances.
And that will add another reason to move the money in and out very quickly.
Yeah. I mean, we've also learned that there's an informal arrangement between some of the local banks to share information.
Right. We will move money out of the country then and maybe back in again from a different source. And that will disrupt that particular network.
Mm. All the time, breaking the transactions into smaller elements, especially where the alerts for money leaving the branch are set at lower levels than for intra-branch transfers.
Yes, meaning that by the time the money is sent out to, say, I don't know, say a nice secret trust account in the BVI or South Dakota, it's almost impossible to trace the money back to a single source, because it may have travelled in smaller parcels through a dozen different accounts in a dozen different countries, for all we know, on the way there.
And from there, we can send it back to the real economy, maybe to buy property in Miami or Monaco or Mayfair.
Nice alliteration for a second week running, right?
Oh, hey. Big fan of the A word.
Terrific. Or we could invest in bonds in the City of London or New York or Frankfurt.
A yacht moored in Saint-Tropez or a watch from Geneva.
A Bugatti, a Ferrari or a Koenigsegg.
A what, Graham?
Koenigsegg, they make luxury cars, right? Nothing very much under $1 million.
Very nice.
Yeah, not my thing at all. But I guess if you're really insecure, it might provide a temporary boost to your ego.
Okay, don't mince your words, Graham.
I could have been a bit more precise about that, but I decided not to. It bugs me, Ray, that lots of these cars are bought with money that was originally intended to pay for hospitals or schools or roads and that sort of boring but rather important infrastructure stuff that taxes were intended for.
I'm with you there, Graham.
Ray, we also need to talk about whether there's such a thing as a specific laundromat. I mean, do we operate our services, as the stories would have you believe, just for the Russians or just for the Azerbaijanis or just for Troika?
Well, no. I mean, our network is too extensive and too expensive to ring fence like that. These stories emerge with specific names because it's easier to explain the narrative that way. But in reality, they're all utilising the same network at different times and maybe from different entry points. But the entities, the proxies, the paperwork is always the same.
And when you say always the same, that's exactly what we mean, isn't it? I mean, it is usually possible to identify a laundromat account just by looking at the wording of the incoming transactions.
Mm-hmm.
The commentary on the SWIFT messages is often repeated word for word across hundreds of different accounts.
Yeah, because if you chance upon something that works, you stick with it, don't you?
You do.
And the transaction amounts are often incredibly similar too.
As anyone who listened to our third ever episode all those years ago, looking specifically at the Danske Bank transactions, will know only too well.
And all this leads to a big problem. Given recent developments in Ukraine and increasingly frantic sanctions against Russian assets here in the UK and elsewhere, one of the greatest hurdles to overcome is actually identifying them.
Yeah, because if we, going back to our imaginary role as global money launderers, just to be clear, if we've done our job properly, there is no concrete way of tracing them back to the point of origin. And all those billions of pounds of property that have been brought into the UK via offshore entities will remain hidden from view.
Mm. Do you know, Graham, I'm kind of going off being an international high-end money launderer.
Right, me too. But we have got one more element to to cover, one that we've touched on before, but I think now we should do in much greater detail.
Oh, yeah, the one involving real goods being shipped all over the world, but not exactly in the manner that the paperwork might suggest.
That's the one.
Well, to a certain extent, I'm looking forward to it.